Blog Talk Radio.
It's time. It's time again for Movie Talk with Vince. That must make me Vince. It does. I am. It's Vince. It's me. I'm back. Here I am for another week, another half hour of talk about, well, the movie. Why not? And this week, I'm going to talk about Monty Python, the movies, the troupe. Why do I love Monty Python? Why should you love Monty Python? Why are Monty Python even around? Why do people talk about Monty Python? Why am I talking about Monty Python? Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that tonight as I go to the movies with Movie Talk with Vince. Monty Python time, whatever. All right, so before I do, remember, there's a guest call-in number. If you want to call in, if you want to talk about Monty Python, give me your views on their movies, their shows, their whatever, give me a call. That number is 914-205-5404. One more time, 914-205-5404. Give me a call. I'll put you on. We can discuss Monty Python if you want. Or you can just sit back and listen as I talk about it. But remember, be warned, as I always say, you're going to hear my opinion. You're going to hear my opinion a lot. As a matter of fact, that's all you're going to hear, and maybe a little bit about history. But I'm going to talk, and I'm going to talk about my opinion, and you might not like it, or you may love it. I don't know. I don't care. Because opinions, they won't hurt you. They're just opinions. We all have them, so let's enjoy them. So beware. And also, spoiler alert, I might give away some strange endings to these films. So beware. If you haven't seen the movies, well, go check them out. But don't worry, I'm going to give everything away so then you don't have to go see it. But no, yes, you do. Because remember, as I always say, don't take my word for it. Go check out the movies. Go make up your own mind. Tell me what you think. So that's right. Let's go. Let's get this thing started. And now, it's... Monty Python's Flying Circus. So as I get this show started, I just want to say a little bit about my history of Monty Python. How did I discover Monty Python? Well, it was way back in the 1970s. One of my best friends, a kid named Shane, and I, we used to watch PBS, and I think it was Shane who introduced me to Monty Python. Or maybe it was at my aunt's and uncle's house. I forget. But I do remember watching Monty Python. I mean, the first episode I saw of the show, The Flying Circus, was an episode that's in which the animation had this globe bouncing around, and at one point you see these footballers, soccer players, British footballers, and the ball bounces around, and there's three of them, and one of their heads just stretches with this excessively long giraffe neck, which comes out of nowhere, and bops it, and then the head, the globe bounces, and it becomes the start of a game show. Well, I thought that was hysterically funny. I still remember to this day, and I just watched the show again and watched that episode. And that bit of the footballer's neck just stretching out, always just stuck with me. I went, my God, what the hell was that? But it was just so off the wall. It was so bizarre. And I remember watching the show, and Shane and I would watch the show, sometimes together, usually at our individual houses. And I believe Shane used to tape it. And I believe he also got their live album, or both of their live albums, Drury Lane and Live at City Center. And he taped it, and I got a tape, and he taped it for me, and I used to listen to that tape over and over and over again to the point where I had every skit memorized. I knew their voices. I could, Shane and I could do the entire skit, the entire album back and forth. We just lived for Monty Python. We couldn't wait to see another episode. I used to think that I'd seen every episode until just recently when I binge-watched it. And I went, oh, I've never seen this one. Oh, I've never seen this. So it was great to watch them all over again. But that's how I discovered Monty Python. But what was Monty Python? Well, let me tell you. Way back in a land called England, in a time called the 60s, there was a couple of groups of British performers. Two of them, Graham Chapman and John Cleese, had been doing a show called The Frost Report and a couple other shows. And another group of British guys, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, and Terry Jones, along with British animator Terry Gilliam, had been doing a show called Do Not Adjust Your Set, which was a show for children. But they were starting to get adults watching the show and realizing that Terry's animation was just off the wall weird. And and Palin, Idle, and Jones's writing and occasional performances on the show were just hysterical. So the BBC decided, yeah, we'll give you guys your own show. So they put them all together, Graham, John, Terry, and Michael and Eric. And Monty Python's Flying Circus was born. The title doesn't mean anything. Because they specifically wanted a title that conveyed absolutely nothing, because the show was, long before Jerry Seinfeld created his show about nothing, this was a show that was absolutely about nothing. None of the skits connected. The skits were just whatever they thought was funny, whatever came off the top of their heads. They didn't have recurring characters, but it wasn't a show that was about, oh, every week you would see The Adventures Of. No, there was no The Adventures Of. This was, every week was something bizarre. And what was great, too, I was just watching a great documentary about the making of Monty Python called The Life of Python, which was made in England, rather appropriately. And I believe Matt Stone of South Park said that one of the things that he loved about the show growing up was what he watched it as a kid, like I did. And for him, because it was a British show, it wasn't on regular TV. You had to watch it on PBS, and you never knew when it was going to be on. So it became like this show that you had to find. And because you had to do that, it became like your show. It wasn't a show that everybody else knew about. It was a show that you could share with your friends, and most of the time they didn't get it. So it made you feel like, I must be better than everybody else. You got a little cocky. You're like, oh, I got my own show. You guys, this isn't yours. And then Matt said that. I was like, oh, my God, that's exactly how I felt. I remember Shane and I, doing these skits together, and, and my family were like, what are you talking about? And I think my parents had probably known what Monty Python was. By this point, Monty Python was already starting to make movies, so it wasn't like they were unpopular. But it was, to me, it was like something special. It wasn't, Three's Company or All in the Family or Barney Miller or whatever other show was being broadcast to millions and millions of people throughout America. This was a weird British show that was old. By the time I was watching the skit, the show was about 10 years old at that point, or at least the first season was. I was watching the show in like the late 70s, early 80s, like 79, 80. The show was already, almost about 10 years old by that point, because the show had premiered in 69. So for me, it was just so exciting to watch. And the humor was just something you didn't see. But that's one of the things that was so great about Monty Python, was because it was so unique, it set the standard. And supposedly, John Cleese, I think, has said that they had called it Monty Python, and they tried to do something that was so unique that the show couldn't be defined. It wasn't like, oh, this is this type of show. It was, no, there was no other show like it. It was just that off the wall. And in America, you couldn't, and I'll say on BBC, they had different standards and practices. So you could show nudity on a BBC program. And in America, it's like, no way, you could never show that. But in England, you could do these things. You could show really raunchy and sometimes rather violent things on television and BBC, as long as you weren't showing people getting like brutally murdered or whatever, because their standard of practices mostly went against violence, but definitely not against sex. They didn't care about sex, as long as it wasn't too graphic. But in America, of course, we're very puritanical, and we're like, oh, no, God forbid, we show, a naked woman on TV. God forbid. So for me as a kid, not being able to see a lot of that stuff, I was like, oh, my God, they're showing, almost all the nudity on the show was simply old paintings that you could see at, your art exhibit or in your art books. But what Terry Gilliam would do is he would take these art paintings and cut them out and move them around, which, of course, is all that what South Park, would do later, decades later. But that's the thing. Because Python was so unique and so groundbreaking for its time, they ended up having to create a term just to describe it, which became the word Python-esque. Lots of times when a show comes out nowadays, like South Park, that is bizarre and off color and uses that kind of animation or that kind of humor, it tended to be called Python-esque because it's like that. A lot of Saturday Night Live stuff later started to follow suit like that. The only big difference, of course, between SNL and Monty Python was in breaking the rules. One of the things that Monty Python wanted to do was to do skits that didn't necessarily have to have an ending, which was always wonderful about the show. They wanted to just make sure they got to the comedy and then not kill it by having some bad punchline. So if they got to the joke and that was as far as the joke was going to go, then they would just leave it, cut the ending into something else. So the show was just so incredibly unique for its time, and it still is for this time. So for anybody who hasn't seen the show, and again, why am I talking about a TV show on Movie Talk? Well, I will get to that. I just recently picked up the entire series for like $40 on DVD. It's now been released in a remastered format, much cheaper. So here I am hawking is something I have no reason to hawk, but I'm going to hawk it anyways because it's so damn good. I say, I go, check out. However you see old programs, maybe you download them from some streaming service on Netflix or whatever. Wherever you can find them, check out the Monty Python shows. Well, now, here's the thing. After they did the first season, I believe it was a producer that worked for Playboy, talked to the troupe and said, look, you guys want to make it big in America? Doing a British show is not going to do it. But if you make a movie, we can show a movie in America, and that would do it. So they took skits from the first season, some skits they'd written that would eventually go into the second season, and made a movie called It Now for Something completely different. And the movie is absolutely great. I'm going to tell you the parts of Monty Python that I don't feel are great, which is very few. What about is it takes the highlights of the show, refilms it in a way that American audiences could appreciate it. But the problem with American audiences at the time didn't, because it's a British movie. And nobody knew what Monty Python was in 1970 when they made this film, 71 I think it was. And so it didn't fly at the time. But if you check it out now, if you haven't seen the show, you need to check out And Now for Something Completely Different. It's the best skits from the show, the Lumberjack song, the Dead Parrot sketch, How Not to Be Seen, so many other great, great, great bits from the first two seasons. And it gives it in a 90-minute format with the animation and everything else. And so it makes it much more easier than having to binge-watch 45 half-hour episodes of a television show made in Britain in between 1969 and 1974, I believe, was the last season. So if you ever get a chance, check that out. Monty Python's And Now for Something Completely Different. That was their first actual film. It's harder to find because it wasn't as popular, but it's picked up a cult following because, like I said, for those of you who don't want to watch the entire series, this gives you the highlights of the series in 90 minutes and you're done. Moving on. Well, they finished up the show, but then by the time they got to after the third season, John Cleese had grown a little bit tired, so he didn't return for the fourth season, but that's okay because they only did, I think, 6 episodes in the fourth season and then called it a day. But by that point, they decided to make a proper film. Like I said, And Now for Something Completely Different wasn't really a proper film. I mean, it is, but it's just highlights of the show. It was nothing really original in the first film. So for the second film, they decided to make an actual original, fairly big budget film. It's a low budget film, but it had bigger budget than the first movie, but still not a very big one. And they shot it on location throughout England, and that movie was called Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And Monty Python and the Holy Grail is probably still considered by many, including myself, it's probably one of the greatest comedies ever done. For this time, they still kept with doing skits, but for the first time, they tried to do a story where the whole thing is not just a bunch of random skits going out of, with different characters. This time, the whole thing was revolved around the story of King Arthur and his search for the Holy Grail. And I think Terry Jones of the troupe, big fan of medieval literature and studied it. And so that's one of the reasons why when he co-directed it with Terry Gilliam, they were very strict on making sure it looked appropriate and not like the old medieval knight films of the 50s and 60s or whatever with the big shining suits of armor. Like, no, they were dirty. They were walking through mud all the time. Everything was wet. So it looked appropriate for the time. It looked realistic for the time. Pardon me. But the jokes are just absolutely out there. so much so that they've become part of the vernacular now. Yeah, people who haven't seen the movie know most of the jokes from the film because people just keep repeating them over and over and over again, regardless of that they've even seen the film. The fact that, you know, I mean, in the movie, just again, one of the things I loved the most about the film was sometimes they had issues because they didn't have a huge budget, and that they ended up using that for the film's benefit. It was almost better that the film had a small budget. If they had a bigger one, some of the jokes would have probably never happened. In the opening shot of the movie, King Arthur is seen riding up to a castle to go, as he's looking for knights to join his team to become knights of the Round Table. Well, he's riding up, and he's not riding on a horse. Instead, he has a man behind him clip-clopping with coconut going. And Bram, as King Arthur, is just putting his hand out as if he's riding a horse, but he's pretending. And the reason why? Because they couldn't afford horses. The budget did not include having and being able to rent horses for all the actors to be riding on. They couldn't afford, you know, 50 or so horses. So they said, let's just not have any and just pretend. And it's hysterical because not only are they pretending, but you're wondering at first, what the hell is he doing? But then they pointed out, as soon as King Arthur walks up to this castle, he says he rode up there, and the guy says, what, on a horse? He's like, of course. He's like, you're not riding on a horse, you're still cooking us. And he points out the ridiculousness of it. And it makes it also funny. So it makes everybody in the audience in on the joke. And that's what's great about the movie, that so much of it is done that way. And I just watched the movie again, and it's one of those films that still to this day still holds up. So much so that the film now has gotten a second lease on life when a couple decades ago, I guess it's been like 20 years maybe it's been. Yeah, probably about 15, 20 years ago, Eric Idle decided to make a little extra coin and with the permission of the rest of the Pythons, decided to completely rip off Monty Python and the Holy Grail and turned it into a musical. Now, the musical is based on the movie, but it goes off in its own direction. Still Eric Idle's writing. So it's got many of the jokes from the film and some of the songs, or I think all the songs, but just expanded out in some cases. But then it goes off into a completely different storyline in the second act. And huge hit on Broadway. And now that it's off Broadway, it's touring around in schools or whatever. I keep seeing auditions from almost everywhere I go. It's almost as popular as shows like Godspell and Rent. Almost all my acting friends, almost every single one of them has either seen or been in Spamalot. It's almost like, like I said, like Rent or Fiddler on the Roof. When I grew up in East Brunswick, in New Jersey, I went to a predominantly Jewish school. I thought it was hysterical that it was, and I grew up in a mostly Christian Catholic school. So when I came to public school in New Jersey, I was completely, my eyes were opened up by this whole new world that I didn't know, which was awesome, which was so great. I felt like such the better person for it. But my friends were like, oh yeah, I did Fiddler on the Roof. Now they're all going, yeah, now I've done Spamalot. Oh, I was in Spamalot. It's like everybody I know is like either, been in the audience of or been on stage for Spamalot. It's become that popular. And it's all due to this, freaking movie that has some of the greatest scenes in it. The Black Knight, still one of the funniest scenes ever filmed, in which John Cleese plays this Black Knight who won't let King Arthur pass across a bridge. So they have to fight. And so they duel it out. And before you know it, Arthur wins by chopping off the knight's arm. Well, the knight doesn't give up. So he ends up having to chop off his other arm. And he still doesn't give up. So he chops off a leg and then another leg. And he still won't give up. And it's so hysterical. You watch him, oh my God, this guy doesn't get it. He's lost. He can't fight anymore. But yet he won't give up. And I think Cleese wrote that because he's like, he's seen people who were just so arrogant that no matter how badly they would lose, they still wouldn't give up. So I got to make a skit out of that. And it's still probably one of the funniest skits that you'll ever see in film. Well, after the movie was over and the movie came, they finished up the series. They took a break. They all went off their separate ways. Cleese created a show called Fawlty Towers, which will be coming back to TV. He and his granddaughter, I believe, are creating a new version of Fawlty Towers. So I'm looking forward to that. But at the time he created that, Eric Idle had his own show. Michael Palin had his own show. I think Terry Jones started directing movies. And then they decided, we want to get back together because, their stuff was still popular, and especially the Holy Grail was become a box office hit. They were starting to make money off of that. And they were also started recording albums that were selling. They started doing concert tours, which were selling. So they're like, let's do another film. We have to. So the story goes that they came up with an idea that originally was started by Eric Idle, who, when asked what their next film would be, his response was, Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory, which was just a joke. They were never going to make a movie about Jesus Christ. Well, they thought, well, why don't we? So they came up with this biblical epic called Life of Brian, which is about a guy named Brian who lived at the time of Christ, and he was confused by other people as being the Christ, but he's not, and he doesn't want to be. He doesn't want followers, but he ends up getting followers without even meaning to, and it becomes a whole big farce about religion and people who, you know, blindly without even realizing what they're following. And so it was a farce, and it's probably one of the greatest movies ever made because of that, because for the first time, Monty Python had a movie that not only was funny, but had something to say, and it was actually kind of important. And it was a farce, and they didn't really mean it to be, and they weren't trying to do a political statement. They were just trying to do something that was funny, and they thought, well, what's funnier to make fun of than, you know, the Catholic Church? So they decided to make fun of it, and why not? That's what they do. They're irreverent. It's always been their blessing. Well, unfortunately, the studio who was going to back it, you know, got scared of that topic, so they dropped them. So at a party, Eric Idle said, you know, met up with Beatle George Harrison, who was a huge fan of Python, and it, you know, it said, oh, what's your next movie going to be? He's like, oh, yeah, well, we lost the funding. We don't know what we're going to do. We started building sets, but now we don't know what we're going to do because we don't have funding. George said, hold on, I'll take care of it. Probably like later that week or a week later, he gave Eric out on call, said, your movie's back on. I'm starting a film company just because I really want to see this movie. And as Eric Idle said, that's got to be the most expensive movie ticket ever created. The guy spent millions of dollars just to see a movie. So that's what he did. He funded the film himself, created a film company called Handmade Films, which is still around, but George Harrison obviously doesn't have anything to do with it since he passed away. But even before he had passed away, he had already given up control of the industry of the company because he was just, I think, tired of producing movies. And a lot of the Handmade Films that weren't made by the Pythons weren't making any money. So he said, yeah, it's not worth it. So he sold it. So I think it does still exist, but it's not, you know, the same anymore. But either way, he created this film studio simply so that Monty Python could make their movie. And the movie became a big hit. It was controversial at the time. People were banning it all over the place, picketing. Christians were all offended because how dare they make fun of Christ, even though Christ is not made fun of at any point in the film. The movie makes fun of Christ's followers, but it doesn't make fun of Christ himself, because as they said, Christ is actually a pretty cool guy who actually said a lot of great things that it's really hard to make fun of. So why bother? Let's make fun of his followers instead. So I think that's probably why Christians got all so upset, because they were like, hey, you're making fun of us. And I'm like, yeah. No. Yeah. You know, get over yourself. So I just watched it again, and it is still probably their best work. The movie holds up still to this day. It has something to say. And the jokes 30 years later, however it's been since, you know, 40 years later, since that film came out, 79, yeah, that's like 40 years ago now. And then they went their separate ways. They, you know, went off to the other things again. And then finally they decided, you know, maybe we should get back to do one more film and then call it a day. That's it. You know, the 80s are now here. Let's do one more movie. And, you know, especially since they were making a lot of money off of what they did. So, hey, you know, let's do one more movie. That's even more money in our pocket. So let's do it. Plus, they love working together. They're good friends. They still are to this day. And so they got back together, and they made one more movie, but they couldn't come up with a good idea for it. And this is where probably their feelings is that their last film, The Meaning of Life, is not their best film, and I agree with them. It isn't as good as the first two, but I do also agree with them that it has some of their best stuff in it. The problem is that the first two, the real two films, Holy Grail and Meaning of Life, have a story, have a plot. You can follow it. They continue on throughout the story. The movie is about a guy named Brian or a guy named King Arthur and their adventures. The Meaning of Life isn't that way. For The Meaning of Life, they decided to go back to what made the show so great and just do a sketch comedy film. But they couldn't just do random skits because Police, I think, was against that. He said that after like a half hour, it'll just start to get boring. You need to have something that links it all together. So they finally, after months and months of trying to come up with an idea, I think it was supposedly Michael Palin, or I think Eric Idle says it might have been his idea, but one of them came up with the idea of the meaning of life. Let's make the whole thing about the meaning of life. So each skit could be about the different stages of man, from birth to through to death. And so the skit, so the films have some of their funniest skits, but it doesn't have a cohesion. It doesn't, and I think that even Eric Idle says that what they should have done is had it be one person's life. It didn't matter whose life it was, but if they just created one character, call him Brian, or not Brian, obviously, because they already used that, but you just call him whatever, then they could have made it, the films have some kind of a cohesion to it, but it doesn't have that. It's just basically a bunch of random skits. But some of those skits are some of the funniest stuff that they've ever done. The Mr. Creosote skit, hugely obese. I mean, when I say hugely obese, I mean like 400 or 500 pound man with his gut that has to be wheeled around on a dolly because he's just so incredibly fat, goes to a French restaurant and eats until he explodes, literally. It's probably one of the most vile things you'll ever see on television, but it is hysterical. And every time I watch it, I just watch it this week, and I just watching it again going, this is still hysterically funny because it's just so wrong on so many levels. And so many other stuff in the film still works to this day because it wasn't topical. It wasn't set in a specific time. It was everything that all the jokes that they did in that film, you know, were timeless. So they still work some 20, 30, 40 years later. So, you know, so The Meaning of Life isn't their best film, but it has some of their best work in it. The jokes in it still work to this day. And so for me, if I can recommend anything to anybody out there, if you really want a good laugh and go, what the hell am I watching? You have to watch any of the Monty Python movies. And unfortunately, The Life of Brian would prove to be it. After they did that, they all went their separate ways. Graham Chapman eventually died of cancer, I believe. He thought that he had a tumor, which proved to be deadly to him. And it took his life, and it took him away from us at the age of, I think, 48. So he was still not much. I'm now older than him, so I've outlived Graham, but still too young. It's like, oh, he was still in his prime, and it robbed us of ever seeing Python get back together again. And now, many times they've said they would never get back together again, but thankfully they did, supposedly because John Cleese was going to get another divorce, and he was going broke from having to pay all these ex-wives. So the rest of the team said, okay, we'll get back together to raise money so John Cleese can stay in his house. And they did a show called Monty Python Live, mostly Five Down, One to Go. Or One Down, Five to Go. That was, yeah. Because it refers to the fact that one of them is dead, and the rest are still alive, but not for long. And since then, Terry Jones has since passed, who's also quite sad. But still, you know, their last reunion was a big live extravaganza that they did, written mostly by Eric, using skits from throughout their career, but with bigger numbers and completely restaged. And it is hysterically funny, but it's kind of weird watching such old men recreate these skits. But they still work, despite the fact that these guys are old. The skits still work, and they are just so damn funny. But it's a great way for them to bookend their career by going back to what they did best and performing their best skits from their shows. There's some bits from their films, like the Not No Coward song is expanded out. To be, which is in the movie, the Monty Python's Life of Brian, the Not Noel Coward song, which is about all how great it is to have a penis, is expanded out to include for the women to sing too, and so the movie version is like a minute long, the play version is hysterically much much longer. Well, anyway, I'm about to wrap up here. The show's almost over, so go check out some Monty Python moves, the movies, and as we end, I have to say, when things are right for bad,
some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make.
Have a good night, everybody. This is Vince. This is Movie Talk, and we will talk again next week. Check out some Monty Python movies; they're great. And don't forget to always look on the side of life. Take care, everybody.
Out for the best, and always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Come on.
Always look on the bright side of life.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance at the end.